to open up the Senate Committee on Education and General Government. We're going to start with a bit of housekeeping for this committee. I'd like to open a work session on the Senate Bill 44, which is the Kindergarten Compromise. You'll see Dash 6 amendment here, which is very similar, identical in content to what we looked at last week. There has been a couple of technical changes made at the request of the Department of Education, and so those are incorporated in the Dash 6s. There's not a fiscal report back yet, so we can't pass it today, so we are going to get one more technical change in the fiscal report and try to move this bill out on Wednesday, if that's okay.
You mean a technical change beyond the sixes?
Beyond this, so we'll be passing out the sevens.
Who's counting, right?
Okay, but who's counting?
That's not that many.
Okay, close the work session on Senate Bill 44, and I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 442. This is a bill to look at directing OUS to consolidate administrative functions and other functions in the university system. And I would like to call up, if we can, kind of as a panel, Jay Kenton, Dixie Lund from EOU, Chris Maples from OIT, Mary Cullinan, SOU, and John Minahan, president of Western Oregon. And Dana, if you could kind of bring us up to speed on what we have in front of us and what the purpose is and some of these reports that you sent out to us here.
Mr. Chair, you did a nice job of summarizing the bill itself. In addition to the measure, obviously in the staff measure summary, there's a report that is entitled the Oregon University System Shared Services Study that I believe Mr. Kenton will be walking us through at the outset.
So colleagues, I don't know if you've got, you see this thing here. This is what you're going to summarize here. And then the university presidents will comment on that, or do you want to just go down the line, or what was your plan, Jay?
That was basically it. I'm going to give you a little bit more background than just that study, but I'll talk about what we've been up to and then turn to my colleagues, and they can, at the system level, they'll talk about at the campus level what they've been doing.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Chairman Hess, members of the committee, my name, for the record, my name is Jay Kenton. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance for the Oregon University System. And I want you to know that the Oregon University System staff, the Board of Higher Education, and the small and regional universities themselves have been wrestling with how to ensure that they are not only financially sustainable, but that they remain robust institutions. And let me briefly outline the work that has been done to date and the work that is continuing to be done at the system level. Once I finish with that, as I said just a minute ago, I'll let the university presidents tell you about their experience and work in this regard. If you go back to 1999, the system adopted the RAM model, the resource allocation model, where funding followed students. And I was at Portland State at the time, but nevertheless in the system. And it was clear after that model was adopted, there might not have been sufficient funding provided for the small and regional universities. And we've come back a couple times. You were very generous last session in providing $9 million to help our small institutions, and I believe we put that money to good use. But that, coupled with enrollment declines at some of these universities, created a situation and financial pressures where these institutions have had to redirect their programs and services to a certain degree. For example, WOU is no longer simply a regional university. They now have a statewide focus and have even begun to increase their international connections. Similarly, OIT, which has always had somewhat of a statewide focus and mission, has changed its programmatic focus from primarily engineering to a greater focus on health professions. EOU and SOU, while still predominantly regionally focused universities, have had to expand their programmatic foci and market areas as well. And that's just a matter of, you know, being sustainable. I was hired as Vice Chancellor for Finance in April 2005, and one of the first assignments I was given by Chancellor Pernsteiner was to investigate this very issue. We began with a comparison of our regional universities to their peers across the country. What we found is the peers generally tended to be larger institutions with enrollments averaging 7,000 FTE. And although the tuition funding per student was roughly equivalent, the other states generally provided more state appropriation per student. We also found that the peers tended to spend more per student FTE on student service and student aid than did their Oregon counterparts. We have also concluded that the success of our regional university is integrally related to two interrelated factors, leadership and enrollment. In every case in recent years, and I believe Lisa handed you the enrollment graphs, you'll see where we've had financial difficulty has been when our enrollment has declined. And that was also at a time when we've had some leadership challenges at those same institutions. Secondly, we analyzed if making these entities branch campuses of one of our larger universities might help. In this case, while there are some economies of scale in administrative and support operations, we concluded that the cultures of the institutions were so vastly different that this could actually end up costing more in the long run. This is due to three factors. One, research universities have a very different workload expectation. They include greater research focus and generally lesser teaching loads than do regional, more teaching-based institutions. Two, research universities also have higher salaries than do their teaching-based counterparts. These are national phenomena that are not unique in Oregon. Finally, three of the four regional universities have unionized faculty, whereas only one of the larger institutions has a union. This is not to say that unions are bad, but only reflects a very different dynamic that is rarely present in research universities. We concluded that these three factors and the cultural implications that come from their existence could actually lead to higher costs at the regional universities, far in excess of whatever administrative savings could result. In addition, we felt that the alumni may lose their identity and willingness to support merged institutions, thereby resulting in decreased philanthropy. Also, political constituencies representing the various states, regions, cities, and counties may believe that they are adversely affected and thereby oppose such a concept as these entities are major economic engines for their respective constituencies. This does not mean that we have abandoned any effort to try to find a more cost-effective and cost-efficient and effective means to operate our regional universities. In fact, we currently have one computer center operated by Oregon State University that supports the administrative needs of these universities. In addition, the Chancellor's Office provides myriad services that are needed by these universities. Some examples of those services are accounting, institutional research, planning, budgeting, etc., that are centralized in the Chancellor's Office and save not only the regional universities, but also some of our larger universities' expenditures in that regard. In addition, last year, a board work group was formed to determine if these universities could share other administrative services to be more efficient. We hired MGT Incorporated to assist with a study that started with the student service support functions, as these functions directly contribute to enrollment success and thereby institutional and financial success. This study, which I believe you have in front of you, determined that we could save money and be more efficient via using a common application, providing automatic articulation with high schools and other higher educational institutions, better utilizing administrative computer systems by using a common financial aid software, by document imaging software, investigating use of a student portal where a student could log into a place and get their bill rather than have it mailed to them each month, by using standard subsystems for room and classroom scheduling, better websites for more robust information, limiting customization of that software, etc. They also found that establishing a one-stop enrollment shop where students could get answers to questions about admissions, financial aid, and enrollment charges could be very helpful. In fact, in the report, I think they suggest something that Southern Oregon was in the process of implementing at that time. They also identified two other areas for further study, converting from quarters to semesters, and better OUS-wide enrollment planning. Many of these recommendations have significant one-time investment costs for implementation, and therefore they represent a longer-term goal, i.e., you may have to pay more today to get a better, lower cost downstream. Since this study, we have continued to work on issues related to improving the administrative systems and sharing services. Today, we have multiple task forces that are evaluating opportunities to streamline administrative systems and share services in enrollment management, that is, admissions, registration, records, and financial aid, human resources, payroll and budget, finance, and information technologies. We also have a commitment from all the presidents, not just these four regionals, but all seven, to work with the chancellor to study a common application, better articulation with high schools and other educational institutions, and system-wide enrollment planning, and other areas for improved efficiency and effectiveness. There have also been conversations with other educational sectors about the possibility of converting to semesters. As you'll recall, we studied that in 1989, and at that time, one of the key factors was if we went to semesters and community colleges didn't, we'd be out of sync with one another, and a lot of our students go back and forth from one institution type to the other.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
But if we were all in semesters, then we'd be in sync with K-12, correct? That does go on quarters. So that's one of the issues we have right now in trying to be seamless is how you can have the connection not just between community colleges and OUS, but also community colleges and K-12. Right. So,
no, I think that's a good point. We're well aware of the challenges ahead of Oregon and are working together to try to best position OUS to meet the state's needs for higher ed in this challenging environment. And that ends what I was going to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or I'd be happy to turn the mic over to one of my colleagues.
Well, very briefly, Mr. Kent, have you implemented any of these recommendations yet into current practice?
I wouldn't say, Chair Haas, I wouldn't say that we have implemented any of them. We are working on them. Some of the automatic articulation with high schools and with community colleges we have implemented. Senate Bill 342, which came out of this body last session, has led to some of that. And many of our universities have articulation agreements with every community college in the state. So I think in that area we're probably ahead of the curve. Some of these systems we are looking at, and we are working with vendors. They do have price tags associated with them, as I mentioned, that we're doing detailed cost-benefit studies right now to determine if the one-time costs, how long it would be before we would be able to recoup those in recurring savings. So that work is ongoing.
One thing the study recognizes or mentions and recommends is to organize their regional universities in a different way than it is now, and to look at placing some of the regionals under what we would call some of the bigs. Have you looked at doing any of that, or what's the status of that recommendation?
Senator Hess, as I mentioned, we did look at, and there are examples. I think when you hear the president speak, you'll hear examples of where they're working very closely with their counterparts, be they other small schools or other large schools. I know Southern is working on an admissions plan with the University of Oregon, et cetera. But when we looked at actually merging them, that was where we got into that cultural issue and some of the costs of doing that and the union, non-union issues that I outlined that we did not view it in our best interest to go in a wholesale way down that pathway.
Okay, well, let's hear from Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you about I was trying to read ahead a little bit about the common application that you mentioned. There's the common application that's sort of a national thing. Are you talking about joining in with that common application that has the unique meaning to high school seniors now, or creating your own application that's common among the Oregon University system?
Yeah, Senator Hess, Senator Bonamici, it's mainly within OUS, although I know the Florida model you can go through a common application and apply to a community college, a higher ed, public or private higher ed institution. And those are some of the things that the task group is actually looking at. How broadly would we go with that? There's certain trepidation in doing that. Many of the schools like having a custom application. They may want certain types of information that others don't, et cetera. And so, you know, we're still looking at whether we're going to go down that path and in what way we would go down it if we did.
Just to follow up so I make sure I understand this. And when you say go down that path, you're looking at having an application that's common to the Oregon University system rather than joining in the national common application?
Yes, Senator Hess, Senator Bonamici, that's correct.
Thank you.
Just to comment on that, and I appreciate that maybe some of the universities have things that they like about their application process, but I would suggest that the application process should be for the benefit of the students, not the university.
So noted.
I'd like to hear from the presidents now who are here. Thank you all for coming. We do have copies, and you have submitted written copies of some of you. You don't have to just read those. If you want to just highlight and summarize, it would be more productive and more helpful to the committee if you could sort of highlight your testimony that's in the record so that we could interrogate you.
Do I have a choice? My name is Dixie Lund, and I am the interim president at Eastern Oregon University, having been appointed to that position 19 months ago. And it is my second time being interim president at Eastern. I served as interim president 03-04 and then was retired for 3 years. I got a call in July of 07 asking if I would come back. We've made a tremendous amount of progress in the last 18, 19 months, and we are starting to finalize the search for my successor. We've had two finalists on campus this last week, and we have two more this week, so I'm confident that the new president will be named probably by about the 1st of April. And as Vice Chancellor Kenton mentioned, I know my peers here all want to thank you for the support that you have given to Oregon Higher Ed and especially to the regional institutions in the last legislative session. It really has made a huge difference. I inherited a huge challenge when I came back in August of 2007. We were on an enrollment decline. We had a severe financial crisis. Morale was poor on campus, and community relations were just shattered. And I was fortunate in that because I've had such a long career at Eastern and had been active in the community that I was rather quickly able to get back onto the campus and reestablish some of those relationships with others. But regardless, we did need to go through a budget reduction plan. We had a very short timeline in which to do that. I came back on August 1st of 07, and by Halloween Day, October 31st of 07, we had to have the rough draft of that repositioning plan submitted to the board. And that plan at the time called for over $4 million in budget cuts. And we are one of the campuses with unionized faculty, so there are timely notice issues associated with terminations that take place there, too. We are progressing on that, and we are in the final months of the second year of that three-year repositioning plan. We are a very lean machine right now. We did eliminate over 20 positions in the process of going through that plan. We serve a population of approximately 3,600 students. We had the largest population of students this last fall. And our students are really spread across three different categories. We have about half of those students participating in a very traditional sense on campus, and the other half in an online arrangement, or what we call an on-site arrangement, where we have cohort groups if there is enough critical mass to be offering courses, especially in our business program and in our education program. Right now, the unemployment rate in Union County is extremely high. The last time it was reported, it was 12.9. We are anticipating with further layoffs in the forest products industry that that may jump even over 15%. For several years, when I was previously employed at Eastern, and then after I was retired, I served on our hospital's board of trustees. And I became even more appreciative of the presence of ELU in our community because it was a factor in being able to recruit a number of new doctors to the area. When they knew that it was a college town and all of the amenities that go on with a college being in that location, it made a difference in being able to recruit medical individuals to our area. We are, our main service area is 12 counties. I'd like to call it 12 counties strong. It is larger than the state of Pennsylvania. One of our finalists is from Pennsylvania, and so he could hardly believe how wide a reach we need to have in serving our immediate service area. Through distance learning, we've been able to establish a number of centers across the state, mainly in locations where there are underserved and or rural populations. We have been, I think, the poster child in Oregon for partnerships. We have partnered with every single institution in the Oregon University system, as well as with many community colleges. Right now, we have a partnership with Southern Oregon to deliver online criminal justice courses, since many of the newer prisons and the expanded prisons are on the east side of the state, and a number of those employees are not degreed and want to pursue degrees. So we work with Southern to design a degree that allows them to get existing coursework online through Southern and then match that up with other varieties of subject areas that they can do from Eastern. We also have a public-private partnership with Oregon Institute of Technology, and this has been a very unique one. The private partner is Oregon Dental Service, ODS, and the result of that is an Associate of Applied Science program delivered in LeGrand over an 18-month period of time in a beautiful building that ODS built on the land that was formerly our Safeway store. And those students do their prerequisites either with Eastern or they come having finished those from other institutions. But they go through an 18-month program and wind up with a degree in dental hygiene, an Associate of Applied Science degree. And then with OIT, they can stay in LeGrand and or move on and pursue their bachelor's degree in dental hygiene through a distance learning program. And President Maples and I had the dubious honor of getting our teeth cleaned together by well, not in the same chair.
But by roommates.
By two young women who are roommates and who are graduating in March. And we got some great publicity on that because it does show a unique partnership and a great way for students to be able to pursue that program with ODS and with OIT. I won't go through the other partnerships that we have, but I'll leave it to say that we have many, including where we are located. Most of our 15 regional sites are within the community college system or within the ESD system. And we have been invited to those locations by those entities in many cases to try to add the 2+2 part to what students can and should be able to get from their home community college. We, as Vice Chancellor Kenton mentioned, we are in discussions with our other regional presidents and staff to find additional ways to try to become more efficient. I will admit that I'm very biased on that because If our unemployment in Union County is already going to be 15% or higher, the last thing that I would like to see happen is to have more layoffs from Eastern Oregon University that adds a burden to the social structure of the state rather than continuing to contribute in the form of income tax from employed individuals. We are considering, and I think our campus is very receptive to the idea of furloughs that is going on. We've talked very openly with our staff about that. We have also talked about reduced FTE as a way to bring the salary expenses down. I think we're alone in this at EOU. We did cancel sabbaticals for those who were planning to apply for such for next year so that we wouldn't have the extra cost of replacement faculty if the main faculty were gone. And we have continued the restrictions on services and supplies, travel, and on professional development. I do want to read just the final paragraph. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Our mission at EOU is clear. We are a university in Eastern Oregon that reaches beyond the boundaries of LeGrand to serve our region and the more rural and underserved areas of the state. We understand rural. We understand small towns and the personal impact of education. Unlike the bigs, we are primarily a teaching institution, although many of our faculty do carry a pretty robust research agenda. And I think I can speak for Eastern Oregonians in saying that we believe in the democratic right and the democratic responsibility for those citizens who choose, as I have for only, I should say, for 55 of my 60 years of life, to live in a rural area, to pay taxes, to gain employment, and to be able to access and afford a public four-year institution that understands the culture. I am a product of EOU, class of 73. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Who wants to be next year?
Go next.
Yes. And if you could focus your remarks to this study in particular, and the concept of regional administrative consolidation.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Haas and committee members. For the record, I'm Mary Cullinan, president of Southern Oregon University, and I do appreciate your invitation to be here today. And I also want to say I'm on the search committee for the president at EOU. And we have had some wonderful candidates that are coming to campus now. It's going to be hard to fill the shoes of President Lund, but I think there are going to be some wonderful people coming. One thing that Vice Chancellor Kenton mentioned is that each of these universities has a somewhat different mission and different processes, et cetera. We are a primarily undergraduate liberal arts institution. Our premier programs are in the arts. Our theater program is known around the country because it's primarily an undergraduate program. Without a graduate program, many, many students come from around the country to be able to have the experience of being in theater in a theater town like Ashland, but also being able to have opportunities that you don't have when you're in a program with a graduate school. So we do offer an approach that is a personalized small school approach with a focus on the arts and a consideration of our bioregion, which is a pretty unique part of the state. And I will address the issue of consolidation or shared services, but I also want to say that, like President Lund, I came into a bit of a mess as well when I came here 2.5 years ago. Our enrollment was down, and we had a $4 million shortfall. We had not changed our expenses when our revenues dropped. And so I've spent the last 2.5 years making significant changes. We went through a retrenchment process. This is the second year of a 3-year retrenchment process. Our goal at the end of this year was to get our fund balance up to 5.4%. But actually, we got ahead of ourselves, and we're going to end this year with 7. Prior to things that have been happening in our budgeting for this current biennium, but we cut 10% of our workforce, which was 50 positions, and really restructured, creating tremendous supports for students. Vice Chancellor Kenton mentioned that in the study that was done last year by MGT, SOU was cited as actually having an exemplary approach to student support, which came about because we were forced into major reorganization in a very, very short time. And so I do want to mention in my testimony there, I've several bullets on our enrollment, and I do want to stress how that has really turned around, due in part to tremendous support in our last legislative session for funding for the regionals.
Were you on a downward scale before then?
Yes.
Enrollment? And then, so the increase, was that a factor of the difficult economic times, or
it was a number of issues. We had a lot of processes that were not working very well for us. We, in our retrenchment, we looked at every single thing that we did, including things like offering financial aid. We offered it a month after every other school in Oregon had offered financial aid to students. And then we were surprised that students weren't choosing Southern. And we had a whole lot of processes like that were simply not, we weren't paying attention. And so I've created a whole new team of vice presidents and directors that are really relooking at the whole way we do business and have created different approaches to support our students and recruit our students. So I'm very, very pleased to provide that list of how much we're up in enrollment from last fall, from one fall to the next. Our retention has gone up tremendously, and we're keeping our students in a way that we weren't before and supporting them. I'm really pleased we had 1,200 students last year that were international students or from out of state. They're bringing new money into Oregon. So that we're seeing for this coming spring that our numbers are up. And I think a lot of it has to do with the atmosphere we've created on campus and the processes that we've put in place. A lot of what we're doing is through partnership already. One of the major reasons that we're successful is we have a tremendous partnership with Rogue Community College. We opened a building there this past fall. We funded that, built that building together with Rogue, and we've created a partnership with Rogue, which is really exemplary. As I understand it, it's the first one in the country like this, where we own the building and operate the building together. And our enrollment in Medford is up 40% over what it was last year. It's a tremendous partnership, and I think one that's very well suited for our region, our effort to get people to come back to school and to finish a degree who thought they were only going to take a few classes at a community college. So that's a partnership that I think is just outstanding, and one that really meets the needs of the region.
Ms. Cullinan, if I can get you to wind up, I want to bring the other presidents up here briefly to speak about this consolidation.
All right. Let me also mention then, just as Vice Chancellor Kenton mentioned, we're in conversations with the University of Oregon on some enrollment issues that I think will benefit both institutions and the people of Oregon. And we have some tremendous conversations with Oregon Institute of Technology that President Maples may speak about, where we're really working together to serve all of Southern Oregon. And I think that's a really important piece. If the two four-year institutions and the community colleges work together in partnership, I think we have a tremendous bonus benefit to the people of Southern Oregon. So that's, I think, a truly wonderful partnership.
I appreciate that. And since you opened that door, I'll walk through it and ask you. It's mentioned in here as an option where some of the research universities like U of O or OSU have some of the regionals collapse into them. And one of the scenarios that came out of this report would be one where Southern Oregon collapses into the University of Oregon, in which buildings aren't closed, but there would be some administrative savings, and it would be the University of Oregon Ashland campus. Are you open to an idea like that?
I certainly, at first blush, don't think that's the most effective way to go. I do feel that one thing that we've done is create this tremendous partnership between Ashland and Medford with our community college. And for me, that serves the region in a way that partnering with U of O would not. On the other hand, as I say, we're deep in talks with U of O about ways we can work together to serve students in different ways, and there are lots of opportunities there. But becoming, you know, U of O Ashland, just as we've really embarked on this tremendous partnership with the community college, I think would be probably not as effective for the region as some other ways to go.
Okay.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Chris Maples, president of OIT. I started in October of 2008, came here from Nevada. By way of background, I think I should tell you why OIT a little bit, as a way of sort of answering part of your question here. My background is research. I was an executive vice president for research at a research institution. I've been at R1 institutions in the Big Ten, Big 12, ACC. I've done research as a program director of the National Science Foundation. So that's a lot of my background in coming here. But I got started at an undergraduate institution in Georgia, West Georgia College, and I chose to go there. I chose not to go to Georgia Tech or the University of Georgia or Auburn or some of the other places I could have gone and had offers. And the reason I did was because I actually wanted that smaller, regional, more hands-on approach. I got to know the faculty. I got to know the students. And as it turns out, that turned out to be very, very beneficial for me. I went to graduate school at Indiana University after that, and when I went to my first graduate class, I got what I came to realize was the typical graduate instruction, which was we went out in the field. I'm a geologist by background. We went out in the field, and the graduate professor said, "You guys know what to do. Go do it, and I'll see you over here." And as it turned out, because I'd had the chance to do hands-on work and learned with faculty and actually been employed by the U.S. Geological Survey with the faculty member at West Georgia, I was the only one there that knew how to do it. And that gave me a lot of confidence, and it gave me a step up in the graduate programs there. OIT is built in large measure on that hands-on approach to life. And one of the things that I will say about the smaller institutions in the regions that we serve is that we have the size allows us a nimbleness to change programs and to change things as the general market dictates. One of the things that OIT has done, it started in 1947 primarily as a vocational school with things like watch repair, gunsmithing, migrated to two-year degrees, migrated to four-year degrees, ramped up in the engineering aspects. Under the leadership of former President Martha Ann Dow, OIT moved into allied health sciences. All of these changes were able to be done, and a dramatically different institution emerges today because of the small size, because of the nimbleness, because of the ability of faculty to be able to understand what the industry needs and wants, and because of our willingness to do it for classes with 20 or 30 students. And you do that for classes of 20 or 30 students who pretty much all go out and get jobs and average starting salaries of $50,000 or more. That's a reasonable economic impact, not just to a region, but to a state and to a general area in the West. We have 7 campuses in Oregon. We have 1 in Seattle, Washington. And that campus in Seattle is a partnership with Boeing. Boeing originally wanted to partner with one of the Washington universities. The Washington universities said, sure, you can send your students, you can send your employees to our campuses. That wasn't what Boeing had in mind. What they had in mind was teaching something at their facility for their employees so that they could get accredited engineering degrees. We offer accredited engineering degrees. the other schools wouldn't bother because it was just too small an effort for them to deal with. Somebody had heard of OIT. We were small enough and interested enough. The programs today have over 120 students. They get accredited engineering degrees, and it makes an average difference in salary of $30,000 a year for each of those employees at Boeing. It's that kind of nimbleness. It's that kind of willingness to partner. You heard about the partnerships that that we're talking about with Southern. You've heard about the partnership that we have with Eastern and with the ODS. It's that kind of flexibility and that willingness to look at doing business differently that I think sets the regionals apart. The other thing about OIT is it does have a national reputation. We're ranked in the top 10 by U.S. News & World Report of baccalaureate awarding institutions in the Western U.S. Western U.S. includes Texas, Colorado, California. It's a broad area. To give you an idea of the company that we're running in, that the number one on that list is the Air Force Academy. I think having the regional approach and being able to carve these niches and be responsive to regional areas and regional concerns and being concerned about relatively small class sizes and responding to a population in that way is a real benefit to everybody in the state, frankly.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Dr. Minahan.
John. Thank you, Senator. I hadn't, frankly, hadn't anticipated speaking very much today, preferring to leave it up to the Vice Chancellor. I tend to get in less trouble that way often.
I understand that.
I've been at Western. This is my fourth year, and I must tell you that our institution is a very strong place.
Dr. Minahan, if you could start out with your name. And
sure. For the record, John Minahan, President of Western Oregon University. I've been there 4 years. This is my fourth year. We set a record enrollment last year at 5,300-plus, and current admissions for the fall indicates that we'll be well above that. In fact, we're about 30% above last year, so we're strong financially. We're strong in all respects, including retention, and we're going to see another jump in what I think is our major obligation in the Mid Willamette Valley, and that is to Hispanic kids and to minority kids, which we have a very high participation rate, and it's up another 30% over last year. So that's part of our public duty. I must tell you, our success has been largely dependent on a strategy that makes us do everything except behave like a regional university. We, in fact, don't know exactly what one would be in the Mid-Valley if a regional university is the kind of place that is a center for both the cultural and educational needs of a region. That's not where we are. We have 8 or 9 private schools, 2 very large public institutions within an hour of us, in fact, 1 within 20 minutes of us. So our strategy for success has been to, in fact, play to our strengths as an academic institution, recruit beyond the boundaries of Oregon as well as in Oregon. Remember what brought us here, which was to be a first-generation institution for kids who have not seen parents in college before. We've done that well, and we're very strong. Even as we go into these bad times, we think we have some strategies to make that work. So we don't generally feel comfortable with the title regional university.
And we appreciate the gains you've made in the last 5 years or so.
Thank you.
Okay, I want to keep this panel up here for some questions. And Mr. Kenton, if you want to rejoin us. You mentioned that none of the recommendations from this study have been implemented. You're still just looking at them?
Senator House or Chair House, I wouldn't say none of them have been implemented. Some have. As I mentioned, the articulation agreements are in place for the most part. And, we received the report in July. And we have continued to talk about it. We've continued to work on it. We haven't concluded that work. And a lot of it is to try to, as I mentioned before, to try to make sure that any savings that accrue from any actions we would take would cover the cost, because there will be costs to implement new systems, et cetera, and we have not completed that work.
Well, you mentioned a couple things at the outset here I just want to challenge you on, and I want to preface this to say that I don't think anybody up here is interested in closing buildings or merging or that sort of thing. And in fact, it's probably just the opposite, increasing access. But, we're also looking at a $3.3 billion hole in the next biennium. And I don't think it's a matter of if there will be consolidation. It's a matter of how thoughtful we can approach this. So that's the purpose of this bill and these hearings. And so I just want you to know that's the spirit in which I'm asking these questions and kind of where we're coming from on this. And I've talked to the committee about this, and I think that's where we all live on this issue. We did not hear from, not that they were invited, but we did not hear from the Cascades campus. What about Bend? How are they faring? Where do they work into possibly administrative consolidation with Eastern or how do we make that a more efficient institution?
Senator Hess, this is a good point. And I debated asking them to come. They are a branch campus. They are not a regional university.
Right.
They were started in about 01. I think they would tell you that there's a certain startup cost associated with starting a new enterprise. They were promised that funding, and as soon as they got started, the funding got cut as part of the 9/11 and the economic crisis that followed that episode. We've been through a couple different directors. There's been some false fits and starts with it. And frankly, I think some of what I mentioned in my earlier testimony, where we have a research institution kind of overseeing basically a teaching institution, may be part of the problem. It's not, in my opinion, based in the community and possibly the way it should be, the way perhaps the community college over there would be. But, they're doing the best they can given the situation, I think. And President Ray would be probably a much better person to talk about than would I.
I appreciate that, but doing the best they can still means that pound for pound, it's a very expensive place to run when you compare it to the other universities. And I guess one of the delicate philosophical questions we have up here is, at what point do we leave that to you, or at what point do we get into the business of managing universities? That's a really important question for me personally. And it's kind of the nub of this debate. I don't think anybody wants to get in and say, here's the application form you should all be using, or even on semester versus quarters. But if it's not going to be done, then I'm not sure, whether we should be empowering or enabling or where we should be on that.
Well, Senator Hess, I think you make good points. They are very difficult decisions. There are local constituencies for each of these. There are political constituencies for each of these issues, as you can imagine. I think you have colleagues that, would advocate for each of these institutions as they were talked about. So, and we are well aware, by the way, I think the presidents would probably laugh when I say this, but I've been very clear with them about the economic picture. We're well aware of what we're confronting. We know we have some difficult decisions. Our board is aware of that. And, I think what our board chair would say if he were here is, give us an outline of what you think it means to us and let us make those decisions. We feel we have, we have the best information to do that. And, to date it's been a difficult situation. We start with a very good governor's recommended budget, and the economy has declined significantly since that time. So the board is aware of the severity of the situation. I think, I've been on the phone with board members and board chairs, vice chairs, as early as just a few hours ago, and talking about these very issues. So,
well, you mentioned, transferring to another culture is a difficult situation when you're talking about consolidating. You mentioned the politics, sort of the intrastate politics. And you mentioned the unions are an issue. I'm not sure, with a $3 billion deficit coming up in a few months, that we can afford to tolerate those kinds of difficult circumstances, because it's going to be difficult in every corner of this state as we write the budget for all things outside of higher ed. So the most common phrase that's come out of this legislation the last few weeks has been skin in the game. In fact, I think it originated with Senator Metzger once at a hearing here. And what would you say the university system is doing to put skin in the game to try to deal with this $3 billion shortfall that we're facing?
Chairman Hess, $46 million has been proposed to be cut from our budget in 07-09. That's 5%, much more than either K through 12 or community colleges, and that's skin in the game, I believe. That's money that largely was carry-forward balances that many of you may feel was owned by the university administration. It's actually money that was generated by faculty over the years that have saved up for that next generation of research equipment or other things, that money's going to be taken, you know, for the purpose of, you know, helping with the budget crisis. And we're more than willing to do our part. I don't want to lead you with thinking that I'm a recalcitrant person. I'm more than willing to change. We're more than willing to address these issues. We are trying to understand how bad it is. I think everyone in this state is. We don't know. You know, right now it's $3 billion next year. I actually thought it'd be closer to five, to be candid. It may be by the time we get to May. But that's from the EBL, by the way. So, you know, we're more than willing to make the difficult decisions. But I think each of my colleagues and I would say, you know, tell us what the numbers are and we'll adapt to it. We'll make the best choices for Oregon. And that's, I guess, the best response I can give you today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask about how we compare in our university system structure with some other states. And as I sat and listened to the testimony, I certainly understand and appreciate the benefits of small class sizes, accessibility to professors, all those benefits that come with being a small institution. However, I know that a lot of small institutions are private, and they have very, very high tuition. And you know, it's a different situation when I certainly don't want to be here advocating for increasing tuition on Oregon students. But that being said, I think that's how some of the small campuses are able to be so successful, because they can do that and raise tuition significantly when they need to and have huge endowments, et cetera. So in our, how does our structure compare where we have several small public universities across our state with some of the other states? And I'm not talking about economically, but just in terms of structure, how do we compare? Thank you.
Chair Hess, Senator Bonamici, I'm not sure I totally understand your question, but
it was very long. I'm sorry.
No. It was a good question. But let me say, as I said earlier, our peer institutions, the peers to Eastern, Western, and Southern, that is, average 7,000 student enrollments, and you can see on the handout I gave you that we're less than that. Our tuition is roughly equivalent to theirs. I mean, in some cases we're a little higher, in some cases we're a little lower. The state funding is largely less than what they get on a per-student basis. So I think they're somewhat comparable. Again, you know, when Don Blair, who's the CFO at Nike, was the leader of that work group that actually brought in MGT, and, you know, when he and I talked about what to do and, you know, how to do it, one of the things we felt is we need to grow these institutions, and in fact, if we're going to hit the 40-40-20 goals that have been outlined for the state, we're going to have to more or less double the number of students that higher ed serves every year from 80,000 to 160,000, and we were hoping that a lot of that growth could occur at these regionals and actually get them, you know, in the 5,000 to 7,000 student range where they start hitting more economies of scale. So I don't know if I've addressed your question directly, but and I'd be happy, you know, we compare with our board. we compare a lot of different financial factors every year of our campuses to their peers, both the large and the small schools. We look at, you know, balance sheet information. We look at income statement. We look at budget per student spending, per student revenues, et cetera. I'd be happy to share all that information with you if you're interested.
Thank you.
Senator Morse? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my interest stems from a little different perspective than creating efficiencies out of merging institutions. And it stems from an article, that an analysis, a study that was done by the Association of Governing Boards and Universities in 2007. And what it did is it looked at the rate of inflation for the major sectors, including higher education, both public and private, healthcare. There were, you know, a whole variety of, I think there was probably at least a half a dozen industry sectors. And it charted the rate of inflation over a time period that was probably maybe 15 to 20 years. And I was really taken aback by the graph that showed that the rate of inflation for higher education, including the publics and the privates, was roughly twice the rate of inflation of healthcare. And we have all been alarmed with the rate of medical inflation, but we have largely overlooked this issue of higher education inflation. And I'm wondering, do you have any sense of how Oregon might compare in that national trend? And it seems to me that in looking, just this is the first time I've seen it, but I just glanced quickly through this analysis, it really doesn't seem to address the systemic issues of education, how we deliver education, because that's probably where the greatest costs are, in the instructional side, not in the student service support side, that how we bend that cost curve. If you've got some thoughts on that, and this, my question is largely unfair because I'm referring to a study that you may or may not All have right. seen.
Well, Chair Hess, Senator Morse, I'm not familiar with that study, first of all, but I do know that the inflation rate has been significant in higher education, and I think it's driven by a number of commodities that we buy. I'd start with our number one most expensive expense is people, and it takes people to deliver higher education. Those costs have gone up, healthcare costs, you know, our benefit package, et cetera, in the state is expensive. We're paying roughly $13,000 per person right now for healthcare. Our OPE rates are roughly double what many of our peer institutions are because of our retirement and healthcare package. But so that's part of it. And those costs have gone up. As you know, healthcare costs were growing at 10 to 15% a year for many years. Utilities is another area. We own 50% of the buildings in the state that are state-owned, and you have to heat, you know, light and power them. And utility inflation has been significant. Similarly, publications like library materials and other things have inflated greatly. I mean, textbooks for students have inflated. Those are things that are beyond our control. We buy from the publishers and, you know, put the things out that our faculty need to teach students or that our libraries need for to support the research that students do. And those commodities have inflated at higher than the average rate of inflation. So I think it's a national phenomenon in some sense. And we do need, you know, it's an interesting concept, because I do think the industry as a whole needs to change. It's going to take a while, like it took a while to change healthcare. And I think it is changing. You heard President Lund talk about their great use of technology. Roughly 50% of their students are taking distance ed classrooms. You've seen the Phoenix universities come into town, and you know they'll cream kind of the high margin programs that don't require the specialized laboratories and other kind of smaller class sizes and expensive faculty. They'll get into the business and some of the liberal arts curricula, but they won't get into the hard science, the engineering things, because of the cost. But It is an expensive area. There's a lot of competition. The scientific equipment that we buy, you know, to do our research, the nanomicroscopes and things, I mean, you're talking about equipment that, you know, costs, you know, a couple million dollars to buy the apparatus, and it has to have a specialized facility with anti-vibration tables and other things that, you know, to support the environmental issues that it requires. So it's an expensive business, there's no question. And we've tried to work, you know, to work it. I suppose, you know, we could do more. But it's a national, I think, issue. And I used to sit on the board of the National Association of College and University Business Officers, and it was discussed at every board meeting. Some institutions actually take great pride. I used to sit by the University of Chicago vice president, and he's like, you know, higher cost means higher quality. And we're striving for quality. And he said, I don't understand you Publix, why you want to be less expensive. But anyway, it's an interesting business, and we're trying to do the best we can, I guess, so I can say.
I didn't mean to cut Jay off, but your timing is interesting to me, because on the drive here from LeGrand, I happened to read an article that refers exactly to what you're talking about. And in addition to the things that Jay has mentioned, there were at least two other dynamics that I had not really thought about. One had to do with the expansion of buildings on college campuses that took place in the 60s. And those buildings now are old. And so you've heard about the deferred maintenance, but that's a real cost in just trying to keep those buildings functional. The other that I think President Minahan and I have especially experienced on our two campuses is the diverse student population that is coming to our campuses that are not prepared, and the extra services that need to go into helping them adjust to college life. Another one, obviously, is all of the regulations that have happened. The ADA compliance is huge. It's a huge expense for us. And those are some things outside of just our normal operating expenses that have added to the overall cost of keeping higher education out there and affordable, which I would put into quotation marks. So I had to slip that in after you'd asked the question.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Since you came back, don't sit down. I have a question for you. Since you came back up, I wanted to ask you about the no out-of-state tuition concept, which I think is very interesting. And I can't find anything in the other regional universities that have that policy. And I wonder if one of the problems of trying to read and listen at the same time, I was trying to go through some of your student profiles, and it sounds like some of the students said that was a factor, a pretty significant factor, in why they are there at your campus from out of state. So have you done some sort of long-term analysis on how that policy has worked? Are you recruiting more students by offering that out-of-state, no out-of-state tuition policy, or do you think you could get the same students and get more in tuition?
Well, when you visualize the state and where LeGrand is located, we have extremely stiff competition from Idaho and from Washington especially. And in fact, in the last year or two, Boise State, the University of Idaho, and WSU all started offering in-state tuition to students from the Treasure Valley and what Washington State calls the border bill. And so all of the counties along the Columbia River, residents from there could go to either WSU Tri-Cities campus or WSU Vancouver campus and pay in-state tuition as long as they stayed right at full-time. That was huge competition for us. The no out-of-state really surfaced, I'm not even sure which year, it seems like it was there when I first started at Eastern in the early 70s. And it was really, my understanding, done to help grow enrollment at the institution because of where we are located in a rural, small population area. And it does work. We are a small institution choice for students from the Treasure Valley as well as from the Tri-Cities area. But it also helped to diversify the campus. Of the recent statistic of the students from the 12 Eastern Oregon counties that go on for post-secondary, 48% of them come to EOU. So we are their college for the students from Eastern Oregon, but because of the size of population, that is not enough to keep the expenses where they need to be. So the out-of-state has helped us with that, with continuing to grow, especially for students who are looking for a small college and are coming from the larger areas in Idaho and Washington.
Mr. Kenton, do you think the current leadership structure is such that these institutions here can make the best decisions for students and the state of Oregon?
Chairman Haas, I do believe they can. I think we need to work together, the system that is, all seven institutions for the betterment of the state. And change is difficult. I've had some very direct conversations with the institutions, conversations that wake me up at night and I see people's faces and the alarm that I caused in their faces in my dreams. And I'm not asking for sympathy here, but we've had very direct conversations. And I think people understand the severity of the situation. And I think we're focused, and I think together we can come up with a solution for the best, in the best interest of the state and its people.
Okay. More questions?
I have one more question.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. Could you talk a little bit about, and I think maybe Vice Chancellor would be the best one, because I'm talking about the whole system. Could you talk about the capacity to grow? Because when you're talking about the peer institutions being, 7,000, do these campuses have room to, well, with some of them, double in size? What would it take to see a significant increase in population, assuming that the students were there?
Right. Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, it's a great question. And we do believe there is capacity. It's variable at each campus. I think some Western may be closer to capacity than, say, others like Eastern or OIT. But we do believe, and I don't know, the presidents would probably be better to speak of this than I, but I think that, there's 30, 40, maybe 50% capacity in some cases. We might have to add some more faculty. If we got that many students, we might have to add some more buildings or facilities to teach them and or expand the schedule or ways we do that. But I believe there's that kind of capacity in these campuses. And I guess I would turn to my colleagues to either, agree or disagree with that statement.
Speaking for Eastern, I would agree with that. And actually, one really nice example of that the last two fall terms was my request to President Frohnmayer at the U of O and to President Ray at OSU to actually send a letter to students who had applied to those institutions and who were academically eligible, but for whom they had insufficient capacity. And they sent letters to those students referring them to consider coming to EOU. And so that's the kind of collaboration and help within the whole system that we need to see more of.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to the presidents. I know you've done good work, difficult circumstances. I wish I could say the circumstances were going to improve. We have some other people signed up to testify here. Max Beach.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Morris, and members of the committee, thank you for being here and good afternoon. My name is Max Beach. I'm the student body president at Western Oregon University, and as well, I am a member of the Oregon Student Association. I would like to begin by just pointing out that Western is in a specifically different situation than many other regional campuses, and I just feel that it's really important to point out and emphasize this. Next, I would like to explain the reasons that OSA is opposed to consolidation of these campuses. It can potentially negatively impact the access to student services, such as the registrar and financial aid offices, by making them centralized and unavailable on campuses to specifically go physically to visit. Financial aid offices are already extremely difficult for students to navigate at times and can be quite busy at certain times in the term, and this would just further problems for students and causing problems for retention at institutions, as well as problems for students' ability to graduate on time. So while I understand that this is only a report that we're discussing, I just felt that it was appropriate to at least address some of the Oregon Student Association's concerns around consolidation and the potential negative effects that consolidation would have on students. Thank you.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate you advocating for your university. Of course, some of what we would ever hope to achieve in the consolidation would be savings that would, you know, ultimately help students the most. So but I appreciate you showing up. Questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
All right, anyone else on Senate Bill 442? Then I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 442. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 118. Dana?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 118 authorizes the State Board of Higher Education to delegate any board powers, duties, or functions to the Chancellor of the Oregon University System or to a president of a state university. It authorizes the board to delegate any board powers, duties, or functions other than the of adopting rules to a committee of the board. And it authorizes the chancellor to delegate specified powers, duties, or functions to an Oregon University System employee. And then we have dash one amendments before us as well. Would you like me to speak to those?
Please.
Those would permit the delegation of board powers, duties, or functions to an operating board established by the board for any particular state institution.
Okay. And we have testimony here from the vice. The chance is different. I'm sorry. Both got up at the same time.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Hageman. I am the legal counsel to the Oregon University System and secretary to the State Board of Higher Education, and appreciate the opportunity to offer some brief comments on Senate Bill 118, and hopefully we'll be able to answer any questions that you have after. What I'm going to basically do is kind of confine my comments to kind of the context which led to the concept to be introduced into Senate Bill 118 from kind of the board strategic planning perspective. About 4 years ago is when this process began in earnest, when the board engaged in its strategic planning exercises, and over the course of 2 years, including two planning retreats, came up with a long-term strategic plan to guide the Oregon University System. That strategic plan is available on our website, and I'm sure that many of you have, in prior testimonies and in prior interactions with the university system, we've made reference to it on multiple occasions. That strategic plan has kind of four broad outcomes that we are interested in: an educated citizenry, high-quality learning to advance knowledge and innovation, and then to cultivate the social and cultural advantages of Oregonians. An emphasis of the strategic plan would be, though, for the Oregon University System to meet the state's needs as in a broad sense. And so after the board, in about 2007, kind of got the strategic plan kind of on course, we turned to questions on how we would go about doing that, and specifically spent, you know, what governance structures would allow the board, the Oregon University System, the chancellor, and the presidents to best be able to implement those four broad, important outcomes to meet the state's needs. And so over the last 2 years, after the strategic plan, we've been engaged in significant governance discussions. One of the precepts in the plan is to meet those needs, we would operate the Oregon University System as a portfolio of institutions, recognizing that every institution couldn't do everything for every student, but as a collective, as a group, the seven institutions with their unique program mix, unique location, unique size, could together meet state needs, and so operating as a portfolio. But spending the last 2 years, the board really engaged in conversation about what governance structures would allow us to best be able to do that. I played a role as legal counsel and secretary in interfacing with the board chair, Chair and the Chancellor to kind of review other systems, review best practices, review professional organizations, review the history of the Oregon University system to kind of come up with some proposals to move forward. One of the things that the board came to conclusion, you know, one thing that we did, for example, was review the board dockets for the last 2 years, just kind of get a sense, what does the board do? The board meets nearly every month for a day to a day and a half meeting with significant transactions on the business ranging from COPs to leases to all sorts of real estate transactions, in addition to broad policy discussions. And over the course of these last 2 years, in examining governance structure, the board came to the conclusion that we want to do something where we add value. We want to add value to the process to get to the goals of that strategic plan. And how do we do that? Well, we want to be a policy board. We want to be a board that creates the policy framework to allow the chancellor and the presidents and the individual institutions to then go meet the outcomes in the strategic plan. So the board kind of went down that avenue, and that's where kind of the genesis of the bill you see in front of you today is to make sure that it's very clear that when the board says, you know what, this is a transaction or this is something that we probably couldn't add much value to, we could create the policy framework in which the chancellor or the institution president can operate, and we'll evaluate the president or the chancellor on whether or not they're meeting those goals. But this is maybe a transaction that would be best delegated to the chancellor or to an institution president. So after 4 years of strategic planning conversations and governance-specific discussions, this bill is a piece of the puzzle to allow the board to move forward in what it thinks would be the best way for it to help operate the system and meet those goals of the strategic plan. So that's kind of where we are today. The board had big governance retreat in January of 2009, just a little over 6 weeks ago, and this is yet another piece of that puzzle. We briefed the board on various straw proposals on committee structures and that review of those board dockets at the last meeting, and the board are going to provide comments. So this is an ongoing conversation, but this is a piece of the puzzle that fits in with how the board best feels it could contribute and add value to the strategic plan of the Oregon University system to meet state needs. So any questions, I would be more than happy to try to answer those.
Is this because the board doesn't want to get buried in minutia on some of these issues? Driving some of this?
Senator Haas, I think so. I think that many of the board members, once they get on the board, quickly come to the realization that there's a lot of things that they rely on the chancellor, the chancellor staff, and the presidents to kind of say, what is this about? What are you doing here? And so I think that the board has realized that there are places where they can add value. And, for example, when I came up with those straw proposals for the retreat, we kind of reformulated the board calendar and really put an emphasis on broad policy discussions and having the board engage in what does quality mean? How do we get to a place where we can direct the chancellor and the institution presidents to achieve quality? What does economic development mean, and what is our role as the system in that? So having a broad policy discussion. There will still be elements of business that the board will retain, and that was also part of the exercise. An example would be setting tuition. The board feels it's very important for them to retain that. Hiring chancellors and presidents. Leadership is very important to the board, and they feel that they can add value by finding top-notch leaders, so they would retain that. But correct, there's a lot of minutia and transactions that the board felt, you know, we can engage in the policy discussion and create the framework in which those transactions can occur, but the experts, the chancellor, the vice chancellor, the presidents are in the best situation to actually make those transactional decisions.
Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this evaluation of governance and essentially reforming or changing the system, was there ever an effort made in a very confidential way to do that would allow the presidents to do an assessment of what we could do that would actually help them and improve the process? So you really have an unbiased, unvarnished assessment of the CEOs that are operating these seven institutions.
Mm-hmm. Senator Haas, Senator Morse, thank you for the question. I would not characterize it as a confidential assessment, and George, The chancellor might have done so in various mechanisms like evaluations. This has been a front burner issue, and so, you know, I'm not familiar to the extent the chancellor confidentially has. I will say, though, that in terms of an unvarnished opinion, the board chair kind of was responsible for convening the work group after the strategic plan was done, and then we shifted to a specific governance discussion. The board chair was responsible for kind of guiding that and individually sought out the opinions of presidents himself. And kind of that was before we really kind of got together, and he charged me with work and gathering research. He himself had conversations with the presidents, which led up to the retreat I spoke of earlier in January. And it was a public meeting, as our meetings are. I will say, even though it was a public meeting, those opinions were quite unvarnished. And in my time, I've been with the system for 5 years, it was the most productive retreat we've ever had, in my opinion, because they were unvarnished, clear opinions. You know, we had the strategic plan as a framework, but it allowed us to move forward. And so the board chair did have confidential conversations, but I felt the retreat was frank, honest, and gave us a foundation to move forward.
Does the board not have the leeway to do some of this now? I mean, in practice, doesn't this already occur?
Senator Hass, substantially it does. I think this is a clarification to ensure that the chancellor would have some latitude to exercise delegated powers from the board. You'll see it's kind of hit or miss throughout the statutory scheme in Chapter 351. There's some situations where there's specific delegation to the presidents. There's some situation where there's delegation to the chancellor. There's mays and shalls. And so I think that given the kind of the thoughtful planning process, this was our way of coming to say, you know what, we want to make sure. We want to be clear that, you know, philosophically everyone's on board with this. This is a way we can think the board can add value, and we just want to make sure. So substantially, yes, though, Senator.
Any other questions? Senator Cruz?
To a degree, it's kind of a reorder, I guess, what's deleted in Section 4 and Section 3 of the bill, as restated now in Section 2. I guess, Mr. Chair, it's just I understand the objective here, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I'm just not quite clear. I mean, for the board to be able to assign some of these functions, I think it's appropriate, and I think they probably can now. I guess my concern is that if we are moving something to where the oversight of the board diminishes to a degree, I have some concerns over the ultimate accountability back to the board of what's going on. I mean, we assign it out to, you know, you could go chancellor, president, committee, and then those steps back to the board, and that it just kind of a concern of mine. I think some of that currently happens now anyway. Reading the deleted language, the new language doesn't necessarily change things dramatically from what I think the board has and the chancellor have the ability to do now. But I guess, especially looking at the dash one, you know, it says, you know, the functional relationship of the operating board to the state board. The state board can determine that by rule. I guess it seems a bit on the vague side to me. So,
Senator Hass, Senator Cruz, I thank you for the question. I can answer that in a couple of ways. In engaging in this process when the board, you know, a necessary question when the board just kind of says, you know, there are things that we would like to delegate, there's also the very important question is what we would like to keep. What do we think is important? And they identified 5 broad themes that they thought we could add value and make sure that this system is accountable in doing what it's meeting the state needs in an accountable and transparent way. Those 5 themes are leadership, financial controls, strategic planning, policy making, and advocacy. And it's, you know, leadership, for example, would be one that the board would say, you know, in order to operate this system, we want top-notch leaders, and we want to have the evaluation mechanisms to make sure they're doing what we want. We're not going to delegate that out. We want, you know, to make sure our chancellor and our presidents are accountable. Financial controls would be another. That is something that, given the statutory scheme and what the board is asked to oversee, and you know, has the duty to oversee, you know, that's something that, you know, in July of 2008 is when they identified these themes in preparation for the retreat. You know, financial controls. We need to make sure the system is operating in a financially stable, sustainable, accountable way. And so part of that dialogue or that conversation was exactly that, or the things that are truly transactional. We can, you know, we can have an evaluation mechanism of a president to figure out, you know, real estate and things like this, you know, but have reports back or have them in their performance evaluations. But then on the other hand, there are things that we would like to keep. So,
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. Let's take the financial structure. I mean, if the board wanted to take a hard look into the financial structure, they're going to create a committee to do the work and have the committee bring back the report and report to the board and make recommendations. I mean, that's the way this happens. So I'm just, I guess to a degree, I'm wondering what problem we're solving here.
Senator Cruz, thank you. Senator Haas's previous comments about kind of there substantially is true. There is quite a bit that the board has the latitude to delegate. But kind of given the process over the last 4 years, we wanted to be very sure, particularly vis-a-vis the chancellor. We wanted to make sure that the board, if it wanted to have something to remain centralized, whether that be some sort of budget allocation function or what some other financial control, that the chancellor would have, the board could expressly delegate that to the chancellor. And so between the mays and the shalls and the statutory scheme and between the various comments on delegation, substantially we are there. I mean, we've, by rule and by policy, we've tried to accomplish as much kind of getting as much transactional duties to the chancellor and the vice chancellor and the presidents as we can. But kind of given the trajectory of the planning retreat and the governance discussions, felt that this statute would just make sure that everyone was on the same page and we could delegate what we thought appropriate to delegate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just a comment. I'm glad that Senator Cruz brought up the vagueness, because I thought it was that the language of any of the powers, duties, or functions was very broad. And when you started talking about the things, well, we won't delegate these certain things, and then you had a list, I wondered, why isn't there more specificity than in this? I'm trying to read between the lines here, and it was helpful that you said these are the things that we won't delegate, and I wonder why that's not in the text of the bill.
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, thank you for the question. It's a good question, and I think that it was more of a drafting exercise. What we were trying to do is kind of take all the spots and cross-references to delegation throughout the scheme and put them up front and say, in this scheme, any of these powers in the scheme could be delegated to very specific people, the chancellor or the presidents or the committee. And so it is, I would grant your comment on breadth, but it's designed maybe to be a little bit more clear as opposed, you know, to kind of to consolidate the statements of delegation throughout the scheme and put them up front to say, you know, in this box, you know, any of the powers in kind of 351 could be delegated to the chancellor, a president, or a committee.
Well, so, has it been a problem to have them in each section?
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, I would not say a problem, but I mean, it does create some confusion, and we feel over the course of the planning process over the last 4 years and the governance discussions, thought that if we really want to make the clear shift from a kind of an operational or transactional board, which I think we have, if you kind of look at our dockets about all the things that get in front of the board, to a policy board, I think that this is we want to make sure. We want to make sure that everyone is on the same page, that the board can delegate to the chancellor or a president or a committee. Do we do a lot of delegation through what's already in the scheme? Absolutely. You know, we do have significant administrative rules on real estate and procurement, for example. So in many ways, yes, some of it is achieved, but I think this is a step to make sure that we can do what we would like to do for the benefit of the state of Oregon and to meet state needs and make sure that the chancellor has the ability to receive delegated powers from the board.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Ryan. We have two more witnesses, Zach Martinson and Melissa Unger. If you both would like to come up, please.
Vice Chair Morris and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. My name is Melissa Unger, and I represent SEIU Local 503 and the 4,000 classified staff at the seven public universities. And we have a couple of concerns, some of the concerns that have already been raised about Senate Bill 118. While I think the stated goal is to streamline the work of the Oregon University System Board, and we wouldn't want to stand in the way of streamlining that work, actually, we think less meetings and streamlined work is good for the system. We're concerned that it's actually just much broader than that. And even if the board isn't going to take advantage of those opportunities now, over the years, we put that in statute that gives them the opportunity to take advantage of delegating any of their powers to the chancellor or to the presidents. For one instance of something we'd be concerned about would be if contract negotiations were delegated to each of the seven universities, the redundancy and bureaucracy that would be created would be large. Seven sets of negotiations and seven bargaining teams and seven sets of lawyers. It would draw resources away from the campuses and the students. Now, we don't think that right now that what they're saying is we would like to hand this down to the seven campuses. Right now in the statute, the chancellor is the point person for contract negotiations, and we're fine with that current system. But what this bill sets up, the process is 10 years down the road or 5 years down the road, that would be a possibility. And we would be concerned about the broadness of that. We believe that if they would like to be specific about certain provisions that they'd like to hand down to the chancellor or to the campuses, that they just be specific about that. One of the things I noticed while reading through the bill was that many of the provisions that have been deleted were they could hand down to the campus, but they couldn't hand down to the chancellor. And so if they would like to be able to hand down all of the kind of administrative duties to the chancellor and then have them report back to the board of directors, I think that would be a fine decision too, as long as we're just specific about what those things are. Throughout Chapter 351, there are powers such as hiring presidents, setting compensation for chancellors and the presidents, electing a president of the board, creating a vision and goals of the system of higher education, approving fees and tuition, which I think should stay with the board. And while that may be the board's current goal, I don't think that we should put things in statute that we don't know, you know, that are there forever, and we don't know where they head. So, and then just kind of as a final note, you know, over the years, SEIU has had concerns that Oregon has trended towards a system of higher education that's more driven by campus by campus and a system-wide approach. Our values around higher education are that Oregon has a system of higher education that meets the goals of the state and educating its citizens and also meeting the demands of its businesses. And we believe that a systematic approach can accomplish these goals. And we worry that Senate Bill 118 continues a trend of a decentralized system of higher education. So I just wanted to raise those concerns around Senate Bill 118 that we have. Thank you. And I can answer any questions.
Okay, any questions? Yes.
Just a question, and I'm going to spin you in a little different direction, but
I can handle it.
Because with education, we're dealing with the K-20 education system, and we've talked a lot about K-12 in terms of funding needs, especially in our particularly dire budget circumstance. We've heard from our community college partners and OUS. And in your testimony, you talk about one of the delegating things like contract negotiations out to seven different campuses would not be very fruitful, rather than having the ability to maintain as we do now, working the contract out so you could, as your testimony said, work on education and not creating full employment for lawyers and human resource experts.
Yeah.
So, and I understand and I agree with that. However, through K through 12, we have 198 school districts that do that, and all separate, negotiated, and would I assume keep those same types of problems. Do you believe it would be better if our K-12 system followed the same model that you advocate with the higher education so that we could centralize those types of agreements and understandings and let everybody get more concerned about, you know, teaching the kids rather than having this decentralized education contractual situation throughout the state?
Vice Chair Morse and Senator Metzger, well, I think that's a valid question based on my testimony. I don't know if I can actually give you an answer just with my experience and my expertise. It's just not in the K-12 funding system, nor in the, which I think is very different than the higher education funding system, and nor is it just with, you know, what those contracts look like. So I don't actually think that I can give you an answer to that. I do think that what my testimony says here about the university system is that, I do believe that seven different campuses, all those workers on those campuses have they currently exist under, you know, the same classifications, the same job, you know, system-wide, and I think that that is beneficial for our current contract at the Oregon University system, but I don't think I have enough information about the K-12 system. I just have never had enough experience with it. I apologize.
No, I understand. That's right, actually. Thank you.
Any other questions? Zach?
Wickle, for the record, my name is Zach Martinson, Vice Chair Morse and members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking the time to hear my testimony today. Currently, I am the Director of State Affairs at the Associated Students of Portland State University. I currently am also the Vice Chair of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Student Association, which represents more than 100,000 students statewide. I am here today in opposition of Senate Bill 118 as it is currently written. This bill was written to allow the State Board of Higher Education to meet less often by allowing it to delegate to the Chancellor some of the more menial and routine tasks of running the university system. It removes several subordinate clauses that mention by name the powers that can be delegated by the Board to the Chancellor, and then, with sweeping language, enables the State Board of Higher Education to delegate any of its decisions and powers to the Chancellor or a university president. This is why we are concerned. The solution proposed in this bill is much wider and all-encompassing than for that which this problem mandates. This bill, in other words, does more than it needs to do and can be written with more specificity. We shouldn't think in terms of what is this bill for, but what would this bill allow? It would legalize the complete evisceration of the State Board of Education, of higher education, my bad. While it wouldn't guarantee that any transfer of power occurs between the State Board and the Chancellor's office, it would allow the State Board to forego even the largest decisions that have a significant statewide effect by delegating them downwards. And while we can't foresee the circumstances under which the State Board would want to allow individual campuses to set their own tuition or sell off student housing or even establish new fees, this bill would ensure that there is no statutory regulation of the extent to which the Oregon University system would be run by the Chancellor or even the university presidents. It should not be put into statute that the governing board of a state school system can effectively absolve its authority if it so chooses, as unlikely as that would be. I'm not speaking against the State Board meeting less often, nor am I saying that we oppose the streamlining of the system's administration. We would just like a solution that fits the problem to be found so that we may clarify statutorily that this is a statewide university system serving a statewide function and thusly should be governed by a statewide board.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Either on the panel or on the board? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We don't have anyone else signed up. Is there anyone that would like to make comments? Hearing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 118, and we're adjourned.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me.
Could you bring us back in, and we'll do a committee vote?
Okay.
Bring us to life.
Yeah, bring us back to life here. I was a little quick with the gavel.
Yeah, I know.
Colleagues, I'd like to open a work session for the introduction of committee bills.
And members of the committee, I apologize. We just received this today. You probably have not seen it, but this legislative concept 3065 would require education service district boards to establish budget review committees, and it provides for the makeup of the committees.
They already have budget review committees, but what the heck.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3065, dated 2/23/09, be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you. Senator Metzger moves that LC 3065, dated 2/23/09, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Adopted.
Mr. Chair, before we close, I just on this last bill, the number of provisions in here with specific authorities and responsibilities and duties to the Board of Higher Ed, it is many, many pages. I think I think there's reason for some caution before we just jump into this thing. So,
okay. Well, I guess, folks, we are adjourned.
Really, really adjourned.
Really.